This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 20th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Doreen Marina. Coming up, big broadcasting companies try to block the FCC's new advertising transparency policy. The Rio Plus 20 conference opens in Brazil.
World leaders must send the signal that they are committed to a sustainable future.
We'll look at the corporate influence on UN development policy and visit one local community who is fighting for a clean environment. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. After this weekend's elections and 2 days of negotiations by Greek political parties, the country finally has a coalition government in place. FSRN's Iris Economou has this update.
Even though the right-wing New Democracy Party won the most votes in Sunday's election, it did not receive the clear majority needed to form the government. After the second place leftist party Syriza refused to create a coalition, New Democracy turned to two less popular parties to form a broad coalition government. The three parties together have 179 out of the 300 seats. With a majority, they hope to push through reforms required to secure a multi-billion dollar bailout. After 2 days of strong negotiations, a coalition government was sworn in this afternoon with Adonis Samaras, leader of the New Democracy Party, as prime minister. Tomorrow, Greek coalition leaders will meet with European authorities in Brussels to discuss a deal for repayment of the country's massive debt. Aris Economou for FSRN in Greece.
Over the past 72 hours, Israeli security forces have killed 9 Palestinians and injured 20 others as rocket fire from Gaza into Israel continues, FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
On Tuesday, Sabir al-Tilbani from the Meghaz refugee camp in central Gaza Strip mourned his teen son Yusuf, who was killed by Israeli army fire along with another friend on the Gaza-Israel border. The Israeli army said the two were attempting to plant explosive devices.
Every day we suffer under such a siege. The occupation seems to be intentionally escalating against the Gaza Strip. Not only was my son killed, others are also being killed, especially those near the borders. They are unarmed civilians.
Drone attacks today left a teenager and 3 others dead. The recent increase in Israeli strikes follows an incident Monday where alleged Gazan militants crossed into Israel from Egypt and killed a construction worker. Over the past few days, several Gaza-based armed factions fired dozens of rockets into nearby Israeli areas. Egyptian mediation efforts are underway to contain current escalation. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Today is International Refugee Day. The United Nations estimates more than 43 million people worldwide are living in situations where they have been forced to leave their homes. One place not often spoken about in the refugee conversation is Senegal. In the past year, a large number of Mauritanian refugees in Senegal have returned home under a voluntary repatriation program organized by the UN. But many of those who remain have started a hunger strike, protesting living conditions in their adopted home. FSRN's Alpha Jallo is in Dakar.
The Mauritanian refugees arrived in Senegal in early 1989 during a conflict over the border between the two countries. Black Mauritanians of Senegalese origin were attacked and killed, prompting many to seek refuge in Senegal. But since then, the refugees say they have been living under challenging conditions in an area outside Dakar. Maimouna Sy is the spokesperson for the Mauritanian refugees.
We are living in a very difficult situation in Senegal. We cannot get food to feed our children or send them to school. We cannot get access to health care if we or our children get sick. But the worst thing is that we are accommodated in the waterlogged suburb of Dakar. We live under terrible conditions.
In response this week, 200 Mauritanian refugees started a hunger strike opposite UN refugee headquarters in Dakar. Their objective, according to Sy, is to get a national and international opinion about their plight. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
A major Gulf of Mexico oil and gas lease sale went ahead today in New Orleans, despite a lawsuit by a group of environmental organizations. As FSRN's Tegan Wendland reports, the suit claims not enough is known about the environmental impact of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill to ensure any future disaster can be mitigated.
The federal government offered about 38 million acres in the first oil and natural gas lease sale in the central Gulf of Mexico since the BP oil spill. But a new lawsuit contends the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has not fully addressed the risks of additional drilling to wildlife in the area. Jacqueline Savitz is vice president of the environmental group Oceana. She says it's unclear whether endangered species like sea turtles and other marine wildlife like bluefin tuna can deal with the stress of new drilling.
It's one thing to say in 2009 or early 2010, we don't think there's an environmental impact from additional drilling. But after the 200 million gallons of oil got dumped in the Gulf, you got to take that into consideration.
Savitz says there are many environmental risks associated with drilling, things like shipping, small amounts of oil in the water, drilling mud, toxic chemicals, and metals. With their lawsuit, Oceana, Defenders of Wildlife, Natural Resources Defense Council, and the Center for Biological Diversity want an injunction, but Savitz says she's not surprised the suit wasn't able to halt Wednesday's sale. A BOEM spokeswoman said the agency does not comment on pending lawsuits. Tegan Wendland, FSRN, Baton Rouge.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, a proposal to increase transparency in political advertising is one step closer to becoming reality after a congressional committee scrapped a provision that would have blocked its implementation. The Federal Communications Commission voted in April to require TV stations in major markets to disclose online who is buying political ads and how much they're paying for them. But the rule still faces several hurdles, including federal review, a lawsuit, and a petition from corporate broadcasters who have fought financial disclosure proposals for many years. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The House Appropriations Subcommittee passed a massive government spending bill last week that included a provision to defund the FCC's recently approved broadcast advertising transparency rule. Missouri Republican Joanne Emerson, the author of the provision, said the agency was out of line.
I find it somewhat perplexing that the FCC is getting mixed up in federal election disclosure matters and placing the burden on private broadcasters.
But when the full committee took up the bill on Wednesday, the provision was withdrawn. New York Democrat Jose Serrano celebrated the move as good for democracy.
Anytime that you say to the public, you can get information on how our elections are being conducted, who's paying for them, what kind of money's being spent, that's a good thing.
Currently, the only way to find out which groups are funding the attack ads and other political messages on TV is to physically travel to a station during business hours and inspect the paper files. The FCC recently approved a rule to make the top four stations in the 50 biggest markets post that information in a searchable online database. And after 2 years, other broadcast stations, except cable and radio outlets, will also have to comply. But this isn't a done deal yet, as opponents of the rule are using multiple methods to block its implementation. Last week, a group of 12 major corporate broadcasters filed a petition for reconsideration to the FCC, saying the ad pricing disclosure would be anti-competitive and disrupt the market. The petition suggests alternatives to the transparency rule, including keeping the files in paper form, posting aggregated but not specific data to the web, and making compliance optional. Matt Wood with the media reform group Free Press says these proposals only serve to weaken and delay the transparency measures.
We'd rather leave well enough alone and just start getting this information out into journalists and voters' hands in advance of the November elections, rather than going back to the FCC yet again and talking about new proposals that would just slow things down.
The National Association of Broadcasters also filed a lawsuit against the FCC in D.C.'s federal appeals court last month, seeking to block the rule, calling it arbitrary, capricious, and inconsistent with the First Amendment. Free Press and other transparency advocates filed briefs this week supporting the FCC, but the case could drag out for many more months. Researcher Bob Biersack at the Center for Responsive Politics criticized these and other attempts to prevent the rule's implementation because the growing onslaught of 501c4 political spending, which he calls dark money, is only going to increase as the election draws closer.
The dark money really means that organizations that don't disclose their donors or in some cases even their spending are very active this year in ways that they haven't been able to be before. They can use corporate money, they can use unlimited contributions from people to run very aggressive television ads, And unless they're so explicit that they say things like vote for or vote against, then depending on the timing of those ads, even the spending itself is not disclosed.
In the 2010 election cycle, these 501c4 nonprofit organizations outspent super PACs, and the Center for Public Integrity found that nearly 90% of the nearly $95 million went undisclosed. The groups, including Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS and the Koch brothers' Americans for Prosperity, pay no taxes and have already bought millions of dollars of advertising in the current election cycle. Biersack says if the FCC rule gets struck down in court or watered down by the agency itself, voters won't be able to access crucial information.
Who's spending this money? Who's running these ads? Who's advocating for and against candidates? I can make judgments myself about whether I think it's important that this particular group or this particular interest is involved in a really big way financially in a campaign, but I can only make those judgments if I actually know what's happening. Right now, the only way to find out is to get into the file cabinet and dig through that paper and see what you can see.
If the new rule survives the broadcaster's lawsuit and petition, it could go into effect as early as this summer. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today in Brazil, the Rio Plus 20 Conference on Sustainable Development officially opened. Nearly 200 nations from around the world are gathering to discuss issues such as alternative energy, urban growth and migration, climate change, and food production. The goal of the UN-backed conference is to put the world on track for a green economy and address rising poverty. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke today after unveiling an all-but-finalized agreement ahead of the talks.
Let us never forget that Rio Plus 20 is about people. We must offer concrete hopes for real improvements in daily lives for the poor, for women and young people, for future generations.
But activists warn that corporate lobbying groups and multinational businesses are shaping the Rio Plus 20 agenda, which threatens the focus on people and local communities. For more, we're joined from Rio by Paul de Klerk. He's Corporate's campaign coordinator with Friends of the Earth International. The environmental organization released a report this week that tracks corporate influence on UN policy. Welcome to FSRN.
Yes, thank you very much.
Let's start with the UN's concept of a green economy, which the conference is pushing as a framework here. How did this concept change since it first came out, and what's the corporate influence on it?
Okay, so when the green economy concept came up 3-4 years ago after the financial crisis, and it was initially a concept that would bring measures or bring all kinds of steps to reduce CO2 emissions and combine that with creating jobs in renewable energies. That seemed a good concept in the beginning, but then since then the green economy concept has been hijacked by companies and specifically the financial sector, which have been pushing a different idea of green economy, and that would be the idea that that nature and biodiversity needs to be priced and be turned into a tradable commodity. So that means that that biodiversity is something that companies and investors can buy or invest in, or they can buy or invest in the services coming from biodiversity, and then they can start trading them.
You talk about the role that companies play in shaping this policy. What about specific companies and specific policies? For instance, Shell Oil, Dow Chemical, Monsanto, Coca-Cola Company, the Chinese oil giant PetroChina. How do they wield influence on the kind of policies that come out from the UN?
Well, there's quite a number of different ways. First of all, the UN has made public-private partnerships with our partnerships with big multinational companies like Shell, Exxon, Rio Tinto, Unilever. So, and that makes that leads to two things. One is that the UN is financially depending on these companies, and secondly, the UN does no longer monitor the negative impacts of these companies and comes up with proposals to regulate these companies to reduce their negative impact, but they are mainly promoting these companies and saying that these are the companies that are doing the right thing. So that's one way, but you also see that that the UN is constantly giving people from the business sector a very prominent place in all kinds of advisory groups. Mr. Ban Ki-moon has set up an initiative which is Sustainable Energy for All. That's one of the cases that we looked at. This is an initiative to improve access to sustainable energy for poor people and also double the share of renewable energy. So he set up that initiative, but then he asked people to advise him, and the main people that he is asking to advise him is representatives from the oil companies, from the financial sector, former CEOs of BP and Shell, representatives from Saudi Arabia and Russia, both countries which are heavily depending on fossil fuels. And that shows very clearly that he is too close to actually the companies which have created the energy crisis and the climate crisis.
Energy is one of the primary themes running through this conference and in the declaration. Another one is food and food production and dealing with hunger. How do you see the corporate influence in the policies coming out on that issue?
We have looked at a case study where the Bill Gates Foundation is working very closely together with some UN agencies. And at the same time, the Bill Gates Foundation has very close links with major food producers like Cargill and other palm soy producers and also companies like Monsanto. And what we see is that through the Bill Gates Foundation and through the UN agencies, actually African countries are being pushed to accept biofuels and GMO products in their country, which is not in the interest of food sovereignty of people in African countries.
We've been talking about the influence of corporate players in shaping this policy on a green economy or on sustainability. Now, to correct this, Friends of the Earth, you're calling for a number of things, including the UN to disclose all relationships with corporate players in shaping this policy. Is that not required now, some level of transparency in this?
In the deal that was proposed by the Brazilian government, companies are not required to make this kind of deals transparent. There is some very weak language in the text that says that companies are encouraged to report on their social and environmental impacts, but this is encouraged and it's based on a voluntary principle, and we've seen that with a lot of companies that they're actually not doing that, or they're doing it in a misleading way, in a way that is not where you can't compare the different companies or over time or within a certain sector.
Paul de Klerk is the coordinator for the corporate campaign at Friends of the Earth International. Friends of the Earth released a report this week called Reclaim the UN from Corporate Capture. Paul de Klerk, he joined us from Rio. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
As delegates at the Summit on Sustainable Development in Rio discuss goals and resolutions, often on a broad scale, one local community located not far from where nations are meeting has been fighting a steel company in their backyard. A district in the western region of the state of Rio de Janeiro, Santa Cruz, is a low-income town with a population of almost 200,000. The effect of the steel company on the community is a tale of failed reform, pollution, and intimidation. FSRN Saki Hall reports.
Multinational corporation ThyssenKrupp, in partnership with the Brazilian company Vale, was the first of a series of companies to build factories on the coast of Sepetiba Bay in Santa Cruz. Residents in the area have been organizing against the factory since its proposal. 2 years after the steel plant's opening, residents say the river, bay, and air are polluted. Rosemary Lopez is one of the residents speaking out against the company and the impact the graphite emission has had on her.
This really sucks. Just so you can understand, I am really tired because this all affects me so directly. I get so disoriented. I can't even go out by myself because I faint. The air pressure is so strong here. When the air pressure is really high, it makes everything swell a lot. Well, I fall over, I faint. I can't handle it anymore. This is why I'm asking for help. I think society should care about us.
Other residents complain of nosebleeds, severe allergy-type symptoms, and skin disorders. The process of heating iron to create steel in blast furnaces emits graphite, which the residents call silver rain. The emission used to be the size of gravel, but after the company installed a filter, it's now a finer particle, more like sand or dust. The Germany-based corporation says the filter installation is, quote, new technology that almost wholly eradicates the risk of graphite dust emission. But residents like Maria Regina Gipaolo argue that the filters have had little impact.
They say that the dust stopped, that there is no more dust in the air. But in the morning, all it takes is for you to put on black clothes and you can see it shining, on the ground and on top of the cars.
Conclusively providing the relationship between the graphite dust emissions and the deteriorating health conditions of the community has proved challenging. The only local doctor to diagnose the connection was threatened and fled the area. Besides the impact on the health of the community, local fishing has been devastated. Jacido Nascimento has been a fisherman all of his life, but he can no longer provide for his family by fishing. He says due to the pollution in the river and the bay, 300 fishermen have lost their income, which their families relied on.
Fishing here was a good living. With 3.5 hours or 4 hours of fishing, I would bring in 3 wide boxes of fish that would bring me an income of $350 to $450 depending on the quality of the fish that I would catch. So let's see, here's what is happening. Today, with the building of the steel plant, we no longer have any fish left to fish that provides a living for us to survive.
ThyssenKrupp is a member of the United Nations Global Compact, a partnership initiative to encourage companies to adopt and report on sustainable and socially responsible policies. International activists participating in Rio Plus 20 criticized a partnership between the UN, governments, and transnational corporations like ThyssenKrupp as a part of the problem and not the solution. The ThyssenKrupp CSA factory is due to export 55 million slabs of steel to processing facilities in Europe and Calvert, Alabama. Residents say they will continue to organize against the company's presence in their community and have several lawsuits pending. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Santa Cruz, Brazil.
With 200 contributing reporters on 6 continents, Free Speech Radio News brings you the news from many corners of the world.
Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Khalid Sid Mohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, Philippines.
While many newsrooms have closed their bureaus overseas, FSRN's network of reporters living in the communities they cover enables us to bring you international coverage each and every weekday. International grassroots reporting that is indispensable and irreplaceable. Support FSRN and our global coverage by visiting our website, fsrn.org. Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, is raising concerns about the safety of civilians in Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. There, the UN-backed Congolese army is fighting with the M23 movement, which the UN says is led by people accused of mass rape, massacres, and recruiting child soldiers. Earlier this month, the Congolese government said they wouldn't negotiate with the rebels, and the fighting is displacing tens of thousands. UN Radio's Patrick Maigwa spoke with the Human Rights Commission's Rupert Colville about who these leaders are and what civilians are facing.
Is it known who are the leaders of this group?
Yes, there's General Bosco Ntaganda, who's wanted by the International Criminal Court. He's an indictee of the Criminal Court. He was a close associate of Thomas Lubanga, who was, in fact, the first person ever to be convicted by the ICC. So he's really the sort of number one leader. But under him, there are a bunch of others at the kind of colonel level who have, you know, really serious allegations against them of massacres, of rape, of recruitment of child soldiers, fighters, abductions, you name it, they've had these allegations. So it's quite a collection of really notorious killers, really, who've assembled at the appear to be leading the M23.
And are there concerns that this group could be committing atrocities?
Well, that has to be, you know, given their track record, that has to be a really major concern. And, you know, people don't get displaced for nothing. People are reluctant to leave their homes. So when you know that already some 200 and more than 200,000 people have fled their homes since April, largely as a result of clashes between M23 and the Congolese army, that's very alarming. So clearly there are more violations taking place. And given what these kind of people have done in the past, then we have to fear the worst for what may be just around the corner.
We've had report there could be reports of children being recruited as soldiers. What do you have on this?
That is a big fear. I mean, several of the people who the High Commissioner named today have that as part of their historical record, that they were using child soldiers. In fact, virtually all the senior commanders she mentions did that. And in fact, recently, MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping force in Congo, actually managed to sort of rescue 20 children from one regiment of the Congolese army. And that regiment was under the previous command of Colonel, someone called Colonel Innocent Zimorinda, who is one of these men now commanding M23. So it looks like he and maybe his other officers were indeed recruiting child soldiers as recently as January of this year.
Has there been any effort on part of the DR Congo to try and arrest the leaders of the M23 group?
Well, yes. I mean, the Congolese army is fighting against M23, and the president, President Kabila, has stated that he wants to see Bosco Ntaganda arrested, as indeed he should be. You know, anyone indicted by the International Criminal Court should be arrested wherever they are. Of course, it's complex because the Congolese army, the FARDC, absorbed quite a few of the militia groups that were plaguing eastern part of DIC over the past 20 years or so. So as part of the kind of efforts to bring peace, they tried to absorb some of these militias, but including some of these really appalling leaders who had, you know, very, very serious crimes allegedly attached to their names. So it's not easy for the Congolese army because these people have themselves been part of the army as a sort of internal cancer, really, in the past few years.
Would the High Commissioner be of the view that the crisis in eastern DR Congo appears to be, you know, making a vicious cycle and the international community needs to do much more to bring it to an end?
I think that you know, it's not as bad as it was in the sort of 1990s or even at the turn of the century. But yes, you know, and really the key factor is this continuing impunity. So it's why really what's happening now is perhaps so important that at least some of these people are caught and jailed, you know, after a fair trial, obviously. But you know, these are people against whom there are really, really terrible allegations.
That was UN Human Rights Commission's Rupert Colville speaking about the ongoing armed conflict in Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kampf. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.